party in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.
Today is Monday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gene Rolfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin reassures Middle East allies of commitment to regional security.
Every day, they're out ensuring that the waterways remain open to commercial traffic.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken calls on African leaders to provide better governance amid threats from violent extremism.
Americans and Africans share a yearning to live in places where their rights are respected, their voices are heard, their governments answer to them.
And protests continue in Sudan despite the reinstatement of Prime Minister by the military. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin on Sunday reassured allies in the Middle East that President Joe Biden's administration was committed to the region, despite Washington increasingly turning its attention towards countering China. Austin spoke during a meeting with U.S. military personnel in Manama, Bahrain, on Saturday. He acknowledged concern in the region and globally that the United States was solely focused on China's challenge. Gulf Arab states heavily reliant on the U.S. military umbrella have expressed uncertainty about Biden's focus on the region, especially after U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Every day, they're out ensuring that the waterways remain open to commercial traffic, and they're working as a part of a task force. It's clear to me, just talking to our partners and allies, that the people in this region continue to appreciate not only our contributions, but our willingness to lead in a number of areas. I think they know that, over the last many, many years, we have been in this region. We have been provided meaningful capability. There's been speculation over a number of years that we're going to leave the region altogether. That hadn't happened. I mean, you're a fleet that's headquartered here in Bahrain. We have tens of thousands of troops in the region. And so sometimes we just kind of need to remind ourselves that there is significant capability here, and we can surge more capability in when needed. So I think we're able to answer questions and reassure our allies and partners, but I think they know that we're going to remain committed to this region. We have interest here. We're going to protect those interests. We're not being provocative. This fleet's been here for a long time, and over that World War II, we've evolved our capabilities every year, every decade. We're going to continue to do that. As the challenges evolve, we'll evolve our capabilities to be able to meet those challenges. And again, I think what's relevant here is also relevant in other places as well. It's what we do. I don't think this should be viewed as provocative. We're going to continue to make sure that we have the right capabilities to keep these important waterways free and open.
That's U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Saudi Arabia, one of Washington's closest regional allies, has been frustrated by the approach of Biden's White House, which has pressed Riyadh to improve its human rights record and end the war in Yemen. Former Saudi intelligence chief Prince Turki Al Faisal, attending the Manama Security Forum, welcomed verbal assurances, but said, quote, demonstrative actions are equally important, unquote. He cited the need to prevent Iran's allied Houthis from obtaining arms. Washington is pressing Riyadh to lift a coalition blockade on Houthi-held areas, a condition from the group for ceasefire talks. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also vowed Saturday to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon and to counter its use of suicide drones. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's comments in Bahrain at the annual Manama dialogue appeared aimed at reassuring America's Gulf Arab allies as the Biden administration tries to revive the nuclear deal, which limited Iran's enrichment of uranium in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. And we remain committed to a diplomatic outcome of the nuclear issue. But if Iran isn't willing to engage seriously, then we will look at all the options necessary to keep the United States secure.
I'm Julie Walker.
Arab media reports that Iranian gunboats stopped an oil tanker in the Gulf Saturday and detained 11 crew members. It is not immediately clear who owns the ship or the nationalities of the crew members. Iranian media are claiming the tanker was smuggling diesel fuel and was stopped inside Iran's territorial waters when it was seized. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iran's Fars news agency reported Saturday a naval unit of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps seized a ship it claimed was smuggling diesel fuel after it allegedly entered Iranian territorial waters. Fars did not indicate which country owns the vessel or nationalities of the crew members who were detained. Fars showed video of an Iranian gunboat carrying soldiers that accosted and boarded the ship. The video appeared to indicate the name of the ship was Mariners, but it was not clear where the ship was registered. The video also showed a box of tissues on the bridge of the ship with Arabic or Persian script on it. IRGC Commander Colonel Ahmed Hajian, who boarded the ship, told Iranian TV that over 150,000 liters of smuggled diesel fuel were on the ship. A video clip showed what appeared to be diesel in the tanks of the vessel. Hajian claimed the ship was in Iranian waters when it was seized. He says that IRGC intelligence has been working to combat fuel smuggling at sea and has been monitoring the movements of foreign vessels in the Persian Gulf. The ship that was seized, he adds, had entered Iranian waters illegally after turning off its electronic and navigation systems. Mirdad Kansari, a former Iranian diplomat based in London, tells VOA that much of what we know so far is speculation, but noted it would seem rather implausible that regional countries would be trying to smuggle diesel fuel into Iran, as the IRGC is claiming.
It's usually Iran that wants to offload diesel to gain some money and things like that. And it's really unlikely for other local countries to be smuggling diesel or products like that.
Iranian ships have been known to smuggle diesel and other fuel oil products to countries like Syria and Yemen. Drones from the U.S. and several other countries are known to keep tabs on the movements of Iranian fuel smuggling, and it is possible that Iran was trying to protect one of its own ships. However, VOA could not confirm the ship was Iranian. Earlier this month, Iran announced it had released a Vietnamese flag tanker that the IRGC had seized in the Sea of Oman several weeks earlier. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is calling on African leaders to provide better governance for their people amid threats from violent extremism, rising authoritarianism, and increasing corruption across the continent. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken has received a warm reception at each stop on his first tour of Africa, including from Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. Blinken made clear that the Biden administration values Nigeria and the whole African continent as a major geopolitical player and a partner on the world stage. But he also waded into the sensitive issues such as reining in sometimes brutal security forces and respecting human rights.
Americans and Africans share a yearning to live in places where their rights are respected, their voices are heard, their governments answer to them and deliver for them. Working together, we can support democracy in our countries and around the world.
Last month, Nigerian youths held memorial protests in Lagos and Abuja, 1 year after security forces violently suppressed mass protests against police brutality and bad governance. Blinken's focus on governments delivering for their citizens was warmly welcomed by Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
We need to start thinking bigger. When the U.S. government talks about governance, it's not just the modalities of elections, really, but governing capacity, service delivery, right? Government that actually works for people. And when it doesn't, that can sort of be reprimanded at the ballot box and move in a new direction.
In a major speech on Africa policy, Blinken addressed the real competition between America and China on the continent, but said that was not his focus.
The United States doesn't want to limit your partnerships with other countries. We want to make your partnerships with us even stronger. We don't want to make you choose. We want to give you choices. Together, we can deliver real benefits to our people on the issues that matter most to them.
Blinken began the trip by reinforcing strong American ties with Kenya and joint efforts to reach a ceasefire to the fighting in Ethiopia. One expert argues that Africa should not be viewed simply through the prism of countering China's influence. Former U.S. Ambassador and former Assistant Secretary of State Johnny Carson spoke with VOA.
I think there is a fundamental difference between the policies being advanced by the Biden administration and the policies that were advanced by the last administration under Secretary Pompeo and former President Trump. The United States under the Biden administration values Africa as an important partner and on global issues ranging from climate change to human trafficking to strengthening our economic links. So it's an important relationship.
Blinken's last stop is Senegal, a predominantly Muslim democracy viewed by many as an island of stability in an increasingly insecure region. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The United States International Climate Pledge is facing a test in the Senate that would have global influence. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
After United Nations climate talks in Scotland, the Biden administration faces the test of fulfilling promises to invest for a new era of clean energy. The House passed a roughly $1.85 trillion social policy and climate bill Friday, including $555 billion for cleaner energy. But the bill must squeeze through the Senate by the narrowest of margins to get passed. Climate scientist and energy analyst Zeke Hausfather says that modeling by researchers at Princeton University and elsewhere finds that if Biden's package passes, the U.S. will still miss the target of cutting fossil fuel emissions in half by the end of this decade, by about 5%. If the bill fails entirely, that falls to 20%. Hausfather says market forces making renewable energy ever cheaper will help carry the United States a lot of the way, but it will be harder for the U.S. to convince other countries like China and India to follow through on their climate commitments if we're unable to follow through on our own promises. Jennifer King, Washington.
Sudan is bracing for more protests despite the reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok by the military. Hundreds of protesters marched towards the presidential palace in Khartoum on Sunday, defying tear gas to reject a deal between Sudan's military leadership and the prime minister. The deal signed with military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan faces opposition from pro-democracy groups that have demanded full civilian rule ever since former longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir was ousted and have been angered by the deaths of dozen protesters in weeks following the October 25th military takeover. A hero for the protest movement, Hamdok quickly became the villain for some. Witnesses say tens of thousands of people joined rallies in the capital Khartoum and its twin cities of Omdurman and Bahri. Security forces fired bullets and tear gas to disperse them. The Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors says a 16-year-old died from being shot in the head by security forces in the city of Omdurman on Sunday. Hamdok says he agreed to the deal to stop the bloodshed. The takeover by the armed forces triggered mass demonstrations against the military and medics aligned with the protest movement, says security forces have killed 40 civilians in increasingly violent crackdowns. For more reaction to the deal, I spoke with reporter Michael Atik.
Many Sudanese who have been already on the street hours before the signing of the deal have been disappointed with the new deal. They consider the Prime Minister Hamdok signing the deal as a betrayal for the Sudanese revolution because they had a lot of hope in Hamdok to come back as a prime minister, but not to be appointed by the military leaders. They rejected, they say the deal does not represent them because it is a deal between the military and Hamdok. Political parties also have been so much also in rejection of the deal. Talking of the coalition of the Sudanese political parties that have initially signed the agreement, the declaration or agreement between the military council, they rejected the deal, saying the deal gives more power to the military to continue holding the transitional period in the coming months. So they say they are going to, you know, mobilize Sudanese citizens to go on the streets and to reject this deal until the civilian government is reinstated back to Sudan to continue the transitional period until a national election is held in the country.
It appears Prime Minister Hamdok had no alternative than to sign on to the deal. Pressure from international community, from the UN, even internal pressure and protest by the Sudanese has been thus unable to push the military to have a change of mind.
It seems to be true that Hamdok has been put in a corner by the international community, by the European Union and African Union, as well as the military leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, also has been put also into another corner. So this pressure has emerged, this agreement, that the two parties are able to agree in a new deal to begin transitional period for Hamdok to be reinstated as the prime minister, so that they are able to win the confidence of the international community. The international community is ready to cooperate with this new government, is able to give funds, is able to give assistance for the transitional period to go ahead. So it looks from the agreement and from the body and from even the timing of the deal itself, it gives a clear message that, yes, both sides have been so much under pressure, even though the speech of both leaders have the initiatives was brought by national parties, national individuals, national technocrats.
With political parties, some Sudanese groups roundly, as you said, condemning this deal, it appears that another round of protests will soon commence.
From the speech of al-Burhan, he talked about the inclusion of participation. So that gives already a room for a new beginning, even if Hamdok is going to form a technocratic and independent government. That is still giving room for political parties to participate. He mentioned clearly that all the political parties, the door will be open for them to participate, in exception of the National Congress, the party of former, the Oster president, Omar al-Bashir. So I believe, yes, there are going to be more protests on the streets.
That's reporter Michael Atit speaking with me from Khartoum. In Burkina Faso, protesters gathered at the outskirts of the capital, Ouagadougou, Sunday, aiming to block a French military convoy that has been trying to reach neighboring Niger. French forces are in the region as part of a fight against Islamist insurgents. Many Burkinabe, however, are upset with France's role and have directed their anger at French forces. Harry Wilkins reports for VOA from the Burkinabe capital.
On Sunday morning, anywhere from 150 to 200 protesters gathered on the outskirts of Ouagadougou to stop the French convoy should it enter the capital from the nearby city of Kaya. From Thursday through Saturday of last week, protesters in Kaya, 97 kilometres north of the capital, staged a blockade of the convoy. An official from the French Defence Ministry told VOA on Sunday that the convoy was routine and the 32nd of its kind to Niamey, Niger, with supplies for troops. Demonstrators said they believed the convoy was carrying weapons to arm terrorist groups which have spread throughout Burkina Faso, killing thousands of civilians and security forces over the last 6 years. Security has deteriorated rapidly in recent months, but there is no evidence to support the protesters' claim. Saturday night, it was reported the convoy had left Kaya after protesters there forced it out. But it was not clear if it was headed to Ouagadougou. Cell phone internet access has been shut down since 10 p.m. local time Saturday, according to netblocks.org, a watchdog group that monitors internet shutdowns. This may indicate a government attempt to suppress further street protests. Nonetheless, protesters had arranged wooden pallets and tyres on the road leading from Kaya to the capital and were flying a Burkinabe flag. The atmosphere was tense, with protesters demanding to know if journalists were working for French media outlets. One protester who refused to give his name spoke to VOA. He said, "We're ready to burn any French material passing by. We do not need France in this country anymore. That's our will." Another wanted to know where the jihadist weapons had come from. From where do the jihadists get their weapons? It's from the French. That's why we've blocked the convoy in Kaya. They shot at us yesterday and three people were injured. We were there yesterday, and today we are back again to block the convoy. Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency reports France has asked Burkina Faso President Roch Kabore to intervene and resolve the situation involving the convoy. According to Reuters, French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian told French television manipulators were behind the anti-French sentiment, but that he hoped for a solution. On Saturday, Burkina Faso security forces in Kaya used tear gas to disperse crowds gathered near a fenced compound where the convoy had been parked. French defence officials say French troops fired warning shots into the air when protesters tried to cut the fence. The French defence officials say there is no way that French troops shot and injured three people and that the incident will not be investigated. Joe Penny is a co-founder of Sahelian.com, a news website focused on the Sahel region.
It's not exactly uncommon for soldiers to shoot in the air to disperse a crowd, but very rarely does that end up with so many people injured. The fact that people were shot in the leg also raises questions for me. And for me, there should be a formal investigation.
There were no security forces at the protest earlier Sunday morning, but a Burkina Faso government official told VOA that efforts were underway to reopen the road. The spokesperson, however, did not address the issue surrounding internet access. Regarding the internet, I do not know if it is a question of technical problems or not, the spokesperson said. By Sunday evening, police had dispersed protesters with tear gas and traffic was beginning to move freely on the road again. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
In other news, Chileans voted for a new president Sunday following a polarizing campaign in which the leading candidates vowed to chart starkly different paths for the region's most economically advanced country, staggered by a recent wave of social unrest. Pre-election polls point to a large number of undecided voters, but consistently have favored two of the seven candidates running, former student protest leader Gabriel Boric and his ideological opposite José Antonio Kast, who has a history of defending Chile's past military dictatorship, but neither is expected to garner enough support to cross the 50% threshold required to avoid a runoff next month. Within striking distance of the two frontrunners are center-right candidate Sebastián Sichel and center-left former education minister Yasna Provoste. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Thousands of Afghans flocked to the Kabul airport in desperate bid to escape Afghanistan after the Taliban took control on August 15th. 18-month-old Fazad arrived with his parents, who handed him across the barbed wire to an American Marine. VOA's Noshaba Ashna reports on the reunion of Fazad and his mother after 43 days, as well as her husband, who is still hoping to flee Afghanistan.
The father of 18-month-old Farzad worked for the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. After the Taliban took over Afghanistan, Farzad's family raced to Kabul airport in hopes of being evacuated from the country.
Since my husband's life was in danger, we left our house and headed to the airport because we heard that Americans were evacuating people who worked with them.
U.S. Marines moved the children inside the airport to shelter them from the high heat and the huge crowds at the gates. Farzad's uncle, Ahmad Zawarzadeh, who was also trying to get his family out, says Farzad was one of the children lifted over barbed wire.
The Marines asked us to give them our children so that they move them to the other side of the gate in the airport. We handed them three of our family's children.
The two families entered the airport 3 hours later and were reunited with two of the three children. But baby Farzad was nowhere to be seen.
After 3 hours of trying to get in, we finally succeeded. After searching for the kids, we found two of them. One of them was my little daughter, and the other one was my niece. But despite efforts, we failed to find the third child.
Farzad's father went back outside the airport looking for his son.
When we lost our son in the airport, my husband left the airport to look for him. He would show my son's photo to everyone, hoping to find him. My husband stayed back to search for my son.
The two families made it out of Afghanistan to a camp in Qatar, leaving a father in search for his son in Kabul, an irony that still puzzles Wahida.
We were leaving my country because my husband's life was in danger. But at the end, it was my husband who stayed back and my son disappeared. Farzad's father is still at risk in Afghanistan.
For 17 days, the 18-year-old mother did not know her son's whereabouts or well-being.
I was feeling as if I were dead, too. It's very difficult for a mother.
That all changed in a Qatari camp when the family received a message.
We hadn't been in communication with anyone in those 2 weeks. After 15 days, when I connected to the newly installed Wi-Fi in the camp, the first message that I noticed was from some folks in Norway. Their message said that Farzad was with them. We were relieved and thankful as they became Farzad's temporary parents.
Farzad stayed in Norway for 43 days while his mother was shifted to a camp in the U.S.
After we arrived in a refugee camp in the U.S., they transported our son from Norway. After confirming he was my child through a DNA test, they gave me my child.
The family resides in Richmond, Virginia, and are now praying for a reunion with Farzad's father, who is still in Kabul, hoping to be evacuated by the U.S. He requested his identity be kept secret for his safety.
I thank the U.S. for reuniting my son with his mother. I miss them a lot and request the U.S. government to include me in this process of evacuation. My family needs me, and I need my family.
For Noshaba Ashna in Richmond, Virginia, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Hundreds of Kurds who had camped along Belarus's border for weeks were forced to return home on Thursday after failing to enter the European Union. At Erbil International Airport, VOA's Kurdish stringer Ahmad Zabari interviewed some of the returnees and filed this report, narrated by Namo Abdallah.
More than 400 Iraqi Kurdish migrants who had fled to Belarus with the goal of reaching Western Europe were returned home on a chartered jet Thursday evening. Migrants speaking at Erbil International Airport in northern Iraq described the difficult living circumstances in Belarus, including frigid weather and little sleep or food.
We were there for 14 days. It was very cold. We saw people starve to death before our eyes. We saw a lot.
The European Union has sanctioned the Belarus government for cracking down on pro-democracy protesters. Since then, Belarus has loosened visa rules for Iraqis and others seeking to visit the country and cross the border into EU territory. According to the Iraqi Kurdistan administration, at least 8,000 migrants, or 40% of the migrants stuck in Belarus, are Kurdish. The rest are Syrian, Iraqi, and Afghan.
At around 2 a.m., people would come and cut the barbed wire for us, telling us to cross the border into Poland now. We were many people, nearly 200 each time. As soon as we crossed the border, the Polish would force us to turn back, but some were lucky enough to make it.
Some claim that they were deported against their will.
After attempting to cross the border 5 or 6 times and failing, the Belarus police arrested us, bringing us to the airport and deporting us.
Others, such as this young man, have pledged to find a way out of Iraqi Kurdistan, which he thinks has no future. For Ahmad Zabari in Erbil, Iraq, Namo Abdullah, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of astrobiologists from the universities of Edinburgh and Oxford has written a study that may help in the search for signs of ancient life on Mars. They caution researchers could be fooled by samples that may look like authentic fossil specimens, but are actually created by chemical and not biological means. Scientists have found some evidence that ancient Mars may have once had conditions that could have made it possible for microbial life to exist. Among the goals of NASA's new Perseverance mission is to look for signs of ancient life on the red planet. Study authors say they have identified many of the processes that could produce samples that impersonate simple life forms that may have existed on Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba ba ba.